Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering Kingston City Council's motion to set a new cooling standard for residential units.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
At their meeting last week, councillors chose to move forward with a motion proposing a new maximum temperature bylaw for residential rental units. While landlords in Ontario are required to provide a minimum level of heat, the same obligation does not exist for air conditioning. The motion suggested an amendment to the existing property standards bylaw requiring landlords or property owners of residential units with air conditioning systems to maintain a temperature not exceeding 26 degrees Celsius from June 1st to September 30th. Environmental and health advocates believe the motion did not go far enough, requesting that the requirement extend to rental units that do not already have air conditioning installed. Anne Fu, Commissioner of Environmental Sustainability with the Queen's University Alma Mater Society, made the case for this amendment before council.
While I am grateful that the city has decided to put forward a motion to adopt a maximum allowable temperature in rental units, I'm disappointed to see that the language only applies to rental units that already have air conditioning systems. Many of Kingston's most precarious renters don't live in units with air conditioning systems in the first place and cannot afford to have them installed on behalf of the landlord. This motion won't help them access cooling, nor anyone else who is low income, disabled, or chronically ill, elderly, or supporting a family. I also want to say that although these testimonies are collected from the student district, this likely applies to many other tenants in many other areas of Kingston. We need a bylaw that not only establishes a maximum temperature in rental units, but that does so in a way that doesn't pass the costs on to tenants and that protects all Kingstonians, regardless of their ability to afford housing and cooling technologies. Through this bylaw, Kingston has a critical opportunity to stand up for the health and safety of its most vulnerable citizens and become a leader alongside other municipalities in Ontario working towards similar laws, including Toronto and Hamilton.
Councillor Jeff McLaren presented a petition with over 1,500 signatures from environmental organizations Seniors for Climate Action Now and 350 Kingston, urging the province of Ontario to direct landlords to keep temperatures in all rental units below 26 degrees Celsius during the summer without passing on costs to residents and tenants. Dr. Henry Swoboda, an emergency physician with Kingston Health Sciences Center, also spoke before council, stating that this is a necessary step to protect public health.
I've seen firsthand the devastating impact of extreme heat, and I have seen what happens when we fail to prepare for predictable disasters due to upfront costs. We see costs in human lives as well as downstream dollar costs that overwhelm our healthcare system. When patients come into the ER with heat illness, I often hear two things from them and their families. One is, I didn't think it was that hot, and two is, we just checked on them and thought they were all right. These statements reveal a dangerous reality. Heat can be sneaky. This isn't just about discomfort, it's about life and death.
A report by the Intact Center on Climate Adaption at Waterloo University named Kingston as one of the Canadian cities projected to be most exposed to extreme heat as the impacts of climate change become more prevalent. According to the report from city staff, very few municipalities in Ontario have a standalone adequate temperature bylaw, with Hamilton and Toronto currently exploring their options to enact a bylaw which would include rental units that do not currently have air conditioning. Robert Mello with the Kingston Property Rental Association, representing about 75 members with thousands of rental units, came to speak against the motion, claiming that the cost to landlords would be too high.
Possible solutions must involve all levels of government providing incentives to make necessary capital improvements. We must work together to meet these challenges. This downloading of costs onto landlords is unsustainable. We do know that there's a number of older buildings here. And of course, a lot of these buildings have tenants that have been there for 10 years and more, and they're paying you know, somewhere between $600 and $1,000 per month rents when hydro alone, this doesn't include sewer and water. Hydro alone is $300 in the month. So it's basically going to push them out of the business. And the, so the low rents, it's just going to be another excuse to just abandon the property or sell it, or you know, it's just going to, there's going to have an effect on housing for sure in the city, guaranteed.
Mello also stressed that the majority of units do not currently have air conditioning installed. When it came time for councillors to discuss, the city's lawyer Jenna Morley warned council that the city may not have the authority to mandate a maximum temperature in all rental units, as air conditioning is not included in landlord obligations in existing provincial legislation.
I'm going to decline to provide any further legal advice in open session this evening, but I would certainly advise council against hastily enacting a bylaw on uncertain jurisdictional grounds without an appreciation for the knock-on effects of that bylaw.
In the end, amendments were made to the motion, and it was decided that council will await the results of the push for this legislation in Toronto and Hamilton, or changes to provincial legislation that would allow the municipality to assuredly move forward with this mandate for all residential units. Councillor Vincent Shinani had the following comment on the amendments.
It could end up being where, say, these other municipalities that are trying to implement this, that they may run into roadblocks or do something like not properly, where we can evaluate that and say, okay, well, this is the mistakes that were made there. Then if we try a different way, learn from their mistakes, or maybe it's successful and then we'd be like, okay, and we could just duplicate it.
Councillor Brandon Tozzo wrapped up his time stating the following.
I think if we vote this motion, we're going to frustrate both people who are advocating for tenants, and we're going to frustrate landlords who are not quite happy with this. Everyone's going to walk out of the room a little bit unhappy, which says to me what the municipality is doing tonight is adequate.
The amended motion passed with a vote of 12-1. With Councillor Gary Osteroff opposed, city staff will report back to council in the coming months with the necessary amending bylaw to provide a new maximum temperature for residential units with air conditioning systems. Other actions in the motion include advocacy to the provincial government and the development of a heat response strategy in partnership with the Southeast Health Unit. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forrestal, about the approval of Napanee's 2025 municipal budget.
Thank you, Jesse. The town of Greater Napanee's 2025 budget is now set, though it was debated right up until the end. The budget passed by a vote of 4-3 at the regular meeting of council on Tuesday, February 11th, 2025. However, an amendment made at the last minute in relation to the much-debated home hardware rink floor replacement increased the amount of the taxation levy by $70,000. Those council members who voted against the budget were the same to vote against that amendment. On December 3, 2024, it was decided that the $70,000 replacement of the flooring at Best & Bash Arena's home hardware rink would be funded through the taxation levy. But this was raised again at the February 4, 2025 special meeting of council when a contradictory resolution was passed to include that the council amend the capital budget to fund the arena flooring from the arena reserve rather than the taxation levy. The debate centered on whether users who wear skates cause more wear and tear to the floor than those who simply walk over it, like seniors and those who use the indoor walking track. After a prolonged debate between council members, it was decided that these funds would come out of a tax levy. This meant the final budget needed to be amended to include the $70,000 flooring replacement cost in the taxation levy. With $2,814,209 in government revenue and $1,149,465 in capital, the total taxation levied was $16,135,412, which has now been amended to include the $70,000 arena floor for a total of $16,205,412. The full budget minus the amended amount can be read on the Greater Napanee Civic Web portal. Meetings of the Council of the Town of Greater Napanee can be viewed virtually or watched afterward on the Napanee Town Council YouTube channel or attended in person at Council Chambers at Napanee Town Hall, 124 John Street. Further information about Council meetings, including agendas and reports, are also available on the web portal. Thank you to Michelle Dory Forsell for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with a report from the LJI reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times' Keith Dempsey about a regional health initiative aimed at bringing physicians to Gananoque.
Thank you, Dinah. Gananoque has agreed to join a regional cost-sharing effort to recruit healthcare professionals. The initiative involves former Ontario Health Minister George Smitherman and Sherry Fournier-Hudson, who previously led a family health team in Brockville. The plan recently got the backing of Prescott Council and the United Counties of Leeds and Grenville. In other Gananoque healthcare news, Greenwood Medical Center has announced its expansion into the region, offering a lifeline to area residents without a family doctor. Unattached patients living in the eastern corridor of the Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington Ontario Health Team, FLAOHT for short, stretching from the Cataraqui Waterway to Gananoque, can now enroll for primary care services through Greenwood. The enrollment process is streamlined through Greenwood's rapid enrollment system, available via greenwoodmedicalcenter.com. The link for enrollment will be active only from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday to Friday, and will be deactivated once patient capacity is reached. To register, eligible individuals must complete a roster form, submit proof of address with accompanying photos, and fill out an intake form. This phased expansion will continue over the next 6 months, focusing on improving healthcare access in the eastern regions of the OHT, including Gananoque.
Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the approval of the Amherst View West development plan.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Staff at Loyalist Township wrapped up over 4 years of planning this week with the approval of the Amherst View West Secondary Plan. The plan acts as a framework to guide future growth and development in the area up until 2046. Work on the project dates back to December 2020, when Council approved the contract with WSP Canada to prepare the plan. Since the project officially launched in 2021, a number of background studies have been completed and amendments have been made. Public engagement opportunities were provided throughout the process, and the final proposed plan is now available to the public. The plan focuses on the urban settlement area of Amherst View, bounded by Taylor Kidd Boulevard to the north, County Road 6 to the west, and Bath Road to the south. According to staff, consultation also took place with the following Indigenous communities: Alderville First Nations, Curve Island First Nations, Hiawatha First Nations, Métis Nation of Ontario, Mississauga of Scugog Island First Nations, and Mohawks of the Bay of Quinte. Mayor Jim Hagedorn noted just how long this project has been going on.
I remember when this started, and then suddenly everything was virtual. Everything changed, but this still continued. And then we were able to come back and complete it in person, which is great.
Project manager with WSP, Nadia DeSanti, explains the engagement program with the community and notes what it entailed.
Over the last 4 years, we've had online, in-person, and hybrid meetings with the community, and we've had a very robust engagement program with the community at large, as well as the Indigenous communities. In terms of what that involved, we had the draft secondary plan presented to the community twice. First one was at a public open house last summer, and then at the statutory meeting in December. And then we also had a community workshop. We've had a couple of meetings with the Indigenous communities that have been engaged and kept informed throughout the entire project.
Hagedorn thanked all that were involved and shared his opinion of the plan.
WSP did a lot of work on this. It was great. They worked well with staff. I also want to thank the public that gave input through the whole process. We had developers, we have property owners, we have just people that are very interested in this development, and they all stayed engaged. They provided information, suggestions, and it really made it so that at this point, it's the best possible document, I believe, and plan to go forward for the township.
DeSanti outlines the next steps.
Following council adoption of the secondary plan, official plan amendment, zoning bylaw amendment, and urban design guidelines, there will be a notice of decision that's issued. Then there's a 20-day appeal period from the date of that notice of decision. Following council adoption as well, the municipal class environmental assessment and notice of completion will be issued. So the environmental study report, the ESR, will be finalized, and it, with the notice of completion, will be available for a 30-day public review. And once that 20-day and 30-day public review process have ended, we're all done.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to a new Corridor contributor, Jack McCool with CJPE, with a story about Prince Edward County's transition to the province's new recycling program.
Hi, I'm Craig Foster, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJPE 99.3 County FM in beautiful Prince Edward County. Coming are some of the top stories from PEC. You can hear County FM news 5 days a week, six times a day on 99.3 County FM, the voice of the county, or stream us at 99.3countyfm.ca.
On February 3rd, it was announced that Prince Edward County will join the nine other members of the Center and South Hastings Waste Services Board, as well as municipalities across Ontario, in the transition to a new residential recycling program. The new program will follow the producer responsibility model outlined by legislation from the Government of Ontario. The change will come into effect on July 17, 2025, and will also see the management of the local Blue Box program shift from Quinney Waste Solutions to Circular Materials Ontario. I spoke to Chris Angelo, Director of Public Works and Environmental Services and Acting CAO at the City of Quinney West, for more information on the upcoming change. Thank you so much again for your time, Chris. I'll just jump right into it. Could you explain what producer responsibility recycling means to those who may not have heard the term before?
Absolutely. So in 2021, the Ministry of Environment, Conservation and Parks proposed legislation that makes producers of the designated blue box materials fully responsible for the end-of-life management of their products and packaging once consumers dispose of them. So really what it does is those responsible for producing the recycling are now responsible for managing it, their end-of-life management of all those products.
Awesome. And just for extra clarification there, just for example, so a restaurant kind of in the Bay of Quinney area, if they sell kind of plastic packaging or something to take food home, it wouldn't be the onus wouldn't be on them necessarily, but it would be on the producer of the actual kind of takeaway container.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. So things like cardboard boxes, the products that come in cardboard boxes, the producers of those cardboard boxes are responsible for that end-of-life management. So the pickup and the processing of all that recycling.
This move has been kind of in the works for some time. So how much work goes into the change kind of on your end and then on other municipalities in the area's end to make the transition kind of as seamless as possible?
Well, for us, we were able to, in 2021, as I suggested earlier, that's when the ministry proposed the changes. And our ability and all the nine member municipalities in Quinney Waste Solutions Board chose the transition of July of 2025, so the last part of the transition period to implement the changes. What we wanted to see is how other municipalities had dealt with the transition and learn from some of the steps that they went through so that we can implement a cohesive and one seamless transition process for all of our residents in the nine member municipalities. So we're set to transition on July 17th of this year that will actually align with our garbage and organics tender, which is due at the same time. And we're extending those contracts to align with the same date. So
I was just wondering if you could explain kind of the impact this will have on kind of the average citizen. I know the press release mentioned kind of a change in recycling collection date, but is there anything else that citizens could expect?
For the typical resident, you won't see any changes to the actual program that starts up on July 21st or July 17th of this year. There may be changes to the day that recycling and or garbage and organics is collected. That's really dependent on the contractors that are being hired by Circular Materials and Material on behalf of the province to pick up the recycling. And for us as a municipality, we want to ensure that for all of our residents, that the recycling day is the same day you're getting your, you're putting out your garbage and organics program. We don't believe having separate collection days for either services is something that our residents would be receptive to. So whatever day the recycling program is on, we'll realign our garbage and organics programs to be on those dates. I understand, though, that the province and Circular Materials of Ontario are looking at changes to the Blue Box program come January 1st of 2026, and the potential with more eligible items to be allowed in the Blue Box coming forward. I don't have those details as of yet, and I'm not sure the province has made those details known, but we understand as of January 1st, more items may be allowed in the Blue Box.
Awesome. So that's something to expect for residents of the local municipalities. And just finally, the ICIs, so the Industrial, Commercial, and Institutional Collection, it says in the press release that it's been handled in a variety of ways across municipalities. Are there any changes that you know of that might be coming to those ICIs?
Typically, ICIs have looked after their in our municipality, and then the 9-member municipalities of Quinte Waste Solutions Board have looked after that themselves. What our council has agreed to is that the non-eligible sources, so things like the downtown business associations, churches, and schools that currently receive Blue Box collection, our municipality has agreed to will continue with that same service. We believe it's in the best interest of our community and the environment to continue with that same level of service as everyone's enjoyed in our community so far.
Awesome. And then just finally, I know you mentioned it there with the Circular Materials Ontario. I think you mentioned that that was kind of a provincial decision to move to that kind of organization. But what are your thoughts on switching from Quinte Waste Solutions, which is kind of more of a local institution?
Well, it's certainly a change with the implementation of the producer responsibility. We, the Quinte Waste Solutions Board, made that decision a number of years ago to, we had the ability to either opt in or opt out of the services. So, and what we chose and all the 9-member municipalities chose is to opt out and have CMO look after the collection and the processing of the recyclings. Other municipalities we've seen throughout the province of Ontario have chose to opt in, and they would manage the recycling program themselves. But for all of us, we decided that in the best interest of our municipalities that we'd let the Circular Materials of Ontario pick up and manage our Blue Box. And in essence, we're saving over $1 million a year in recycling costs that our typical residents would have typically paid over the last several years. That cost is now being borne by the producers and is something that we can remove from our budget process.
Awesome. Thank you so much again for your time, Chris. I really appreciate it. And I think this will be valuable for kind of the people within those 9 municipalities to know what to expect come July 17th. So thank you again so much for your time.
You bet.
Any changes to your local collection service will be communicated to you by your municipality starting in the spring. For the Local Journalism Initiative, FrequencyNews.ca and 99.3 County FM, I'm Jack McCool, filling in for Brenda Little.
Thank you to Jack McCool for that story. Over now to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN Coburg, Dan Jones, with a story about the 2025 goals for the newly merged Haliburton, Kawartha, Northumberland, Peterborough Health Unit.
As two public health units continue with merging operations, the board of directors and leadership are attempting to reassure the public that their health needs will continue to be a priority in changing times. In January, the Haliburton Kawartha Pine Ridge District Health Unit and Peterborough Public Health completed their voluntary merger, with the singular health unit now being referred to as the Haliburton Kawartha Northumberland Peterborough Health Unit. The new board of directors announced that former Peterborough Public Health Unit CEO and Medical Officer of Health, Dr. Thomas Piggott, will serve as the new CEO of the Amalgamated Health Unit last week. On Monday, Piggott addressed the media for the first time, saying his focus will be in two areas: maintaining current public health services, and working with staff on efficiencies.
There aren't direct public-facing changes that you'll have seen so far. Even though our teams have been working hard to bring our back offices together and find efficiencies and opportunities, our services will change slowly and thoughtfully, deliberatively, with consultation of the community.
Dr. Pigott joined Peterborough Public Health in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic in December 2021. He says changes learned through that health crisis will be a catalyst for preparing this new health unit for future health disasters.
As you'll know, with the COVID-19 pandemic, it had a significant toll, including on our own staff as well. And the challenges that we had through the COVID-19 pandemic are some of what I'm really hopeful that we can address through this merger to have better readiness and capacity to respond to future health emergencies, pandemic threats.
Dr. Natalie Bocking, who is the former Medical Officer of Health and CEO of the Halliburton-Kawartha Pine Ridge District Health Unit, will now serve as the Deputy Medical Officer of Health for the region. Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
Thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada weather report for the City of Kingston. Thursday, February 20th, we're going to see slightly warmer conditions with a daytime high of -6, a mix of sun and cloud with a 30% chance of flurries, and an overnight low of -11. Friday, February 21st, we will see a daytime high of -4 with an overnight low of -12 and a mix of sun and cloud throughout the day. Saturday, February 22nd, slightly warmer, daytime high of -2, overnight low of -11 with cloudy conditions. And Sunday, February 23rd, daytime high of -2 with an overnight low of -7.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.